Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
Current state on WKAR. Welcome back to the show. We're glad you're here. I'm Mark Bayshore. City Pulse tweets that third quarter revenues and expenditures are on track. That's according to the City of Lansing Finance Department. Third quarter revenues and expenditures are on track. A tweet from City Pulse this morning, and by now I'm sure you know Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero makes it official today. He will run again for mayor. It's current state here on WKAR. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org. At the top of the program today, the U.S. military is facing a crisis of confidence. This week, the Pentagon released an annual report indicating the rate of rape and sexual assault by and against service members has risen significantly in the past year. Adding to the scandal is the arrest of the Air Force officer who previously led that branch's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Unit, who himself was charged with sexual assault. On Monday, WKAR-TV will air an Oscar-nominated documentary that takes an unflinching view of this painful subject. The Invisible War features interviews with several victims who tell their stories. Current State's Kevin Lavery spoke with the film's writer and director, Kirby Dick, and he asked him how he and his crew found so many people willing to come forward.
Well, that was a real challenge. As you can imagine, men and women certainly do not want to talk about this kind of thing. And some of them actually were genuinely afraid perhaps that their perpetrator would come after them. So we actually undertook a very extensive outreach program to find these men and women. We worked through therapists, victims' advocates, attorneys, other survivors. And we also actually did a lot of research on the internet, looking for on Facebook or other places if there were comments that people were making, perhaps just something as oblique as, you know, there's a discussion about rape in the military and somebody might comment, "I know what you're talking about." We would reach out to them and see if they wanted to speak about the issue off the record. And they, you know, and more often than not, they'd been assaulted. And then we would, you know, at that point, once they learned about our project, in most cases, they were very interested in becoming a part of it.
I'm going to assume that there were probably more people who reached out to you and your crew than are represented in the film. Was that surprising to you that many people would make that personal leap of faith?
Well, yes, it was. I mean, this is a very big step. I mean, this is something that had been covered up for a long, long time. And I think a lot of people, you know, even though the numbers were there, a lot of people just didn't believe that it was a real serious problem. And so for these people to stand up like this was very courageous. I mean, in essence, they were whistleblowers. And but, you know, once we sat down with them, I think they were very reassured because, you know, their experience before is whenever they spoke about it, particularly when they reported to the military turned on them, investigated them rather than their perpetrator. So to have a film crew come and say, you know, we believe you, we understand what you went through because we've spoken to 100 other men and women who've gone through this and your story is identical. And that's why this film has to be made, because there are so many, you know, tens and really hundreds of thousands of people like you who've gone through this experience. And it's really important to get the word out so that more men and women aren't sexually assaulted in the military.
How much information that you eventually found, how much of it was freely given to you or perhaps not freely given to you by the military and how much by other sources? Was it difficult to independently verify information, to corroborate data on this?
It took some time, yes. I mean, the military was not very forthcoming about information, and they, even to this day, I would say that still is the case. I mean, there is certainly improvements been made, but, you know, you see with this report that has come out just a couple of days ago that the number of men and women who are sexually assaulted in the U.S. military in fiscal year 2012 was 26,000. That's up from 19,000 in fiscal year 2011. And yet the military is saying, you know, we really don't quite understand what this problem is. And you know, I people who work with this are very clear, you know, what the issue is. But yes, it was difficult to corroborate a lot of this initially, and we had to, one of the things we had to do was also undertake a very extensive search to find people who were involved in the criminal justice system, who'd retired from it, but who knew how things worked in the military criminal justice system firsthand, and were able to corroborate what the survivors were telling us, you know, about their experiences.
You mentioned the Department of Defense's report that came out this week, and as you allude to, the timing of PBS Independent Lens airing this nationally is extraordinary, given that this just came out this week. I'm wondering, since your film was made, if you have been able to follow any truly impacting, significant changes in the way the military conducts its investigations and follows through with accusations.
Well, you know, there have been some significant changes, no question about it. I know they've allotted a significant amount of additional monies to investigators, I think in all the branches. They are in the Air Force, and I think in other branches are as well, discussing this of having an attorney that's assigned specifically to the victim who comes forward, because it's such a difficult process to negotiate, particularly because it's not something... You know, you can't go to, you know, you have to stay in your job when you do this. And the difference is, you know, in the civilian world, if you're assaulted and it's too difficult, you can go back and live with your family and get that kind of support. Here, it's among the most difficult. I know also, I mean, they've been using the film as part of their sexual assault training program, which I think is a sign that, you know, they are beginning to take this seriously. The problem is, and it's still a huge problem, is on the prosecution side, where they're not making the changes that they really need to make. The one thing that needs to be done is the decision to investigate and prosecute these crimes has to be taken out of the chain of command so that there isn't a conflict of interest. It has to be put in, it can be put into to the military justice system, and trained prosecutors, trained judges should be making the decisions, not senior officers in the chain of command. And the reason for that is there's this institutional bias that a commander, you know, may know the assailant or may know the commander of the assailant. That's very possible. And then there, you know, would just naturally, any person would tend to often, very often, defense, you know, or, you know, protect somebody that they have a personal relationship with. But even more importantly, the people who are reporting, the victims, perceive that institutional bias, and they don't report. And if you look at the statistics, just as came out, that the rate of reporting dropped dramatically, 28%. It was lower, 28%. So now the actual rate of reporting is under 10%. And that means 90% of sexual assaults in the military are not reported. And we know that most of these sexual assaults are caused by serial predators, you know, men mostly, who assault again and again. Until the military makes this one change, which is taking it outside of the chain of command, putting it in the hand of trained prosecutors, they will continue to have people not reporting, and they will never solve this problem. Congress finally is stepping up to address this problem, in the Senate particularly, which has been dormant for a long time. But Senator Gillibrand is of New York is going to be introducing a bill next week that does just that, that takes it out of the chain of command. And this will be historic. If she's able to get this through, this will be the single most important reform to, you know, address this issue of sexual assault in the military.
This is a very wrenching film to watch, and it follows the lives of mainly women, a handful of men. I'd like to play a clip, if you don't mind, Mr.
Sure.
Dick. This is a former Marine, Lieutenant Ariana Clay, and this particular interview just the trauma that her husband went through in particular truly struck me. So let's listen to that now.
The actions of my seniors, both in the assault and in the ensuing investigations, have really destroyed me.
When your wife doesn't come home to rummage through the app, searching for the suicide note, to call the police with one hand while you're restraining her from killing herself with the other.
I think a lot of your film is making the point that there is an enormous ripple effect that happens for a long time after the incident itself, and it doesn't just include the victim.
That's very true. I mean, it's the families, it's the spouses, it's the children, it's the extended family, it's even the community. This is something that, these men and women who are sexually assaulted are, referred to as survivors, because this is something that stays with them the rest of their lives, and it also stays with, and also people that are close to them are affected by this the rest of their lives. So that it's, this is something that, and if you look at the numbers, the total numbers, there's no question then between 500,000 and 1 million men and women have been sexually assaulted in the military over the last several generations. And then you multiply that by the people that are close to them, and that means millions of people are affected by this. Their lives are changed by this and changed for the worse. So, yes, it's a national problem completely.
What did you see or learn from the subjects of your film when your cameras were turned off that are not conveyed in the film?
It's actually quite interesting. The veterans it's real pleasure to be around them. They're very socially sophisticated, very funny. There's they have a real good sense of practical jokes. And it's so even though these, men and women were telling you these very painful stories, when we weren't talking about those things and, we were hanging around, we were shooting, sometimes we were spending several days with these people, it was a real pleasure to be with them. I think the reason is that being in the military, you're living with people 24/7, so you develop a real, highly developed kind of social skills, really. And so it was, that was, I guess that would be the one thing that the film doesn't focus on, but it made it very enjoyable to make the film.
What response are you expecting to receive again, just days after this scathing report from the military about rape and sexual assault?
Well, we're very pleased that it's on PBS. We're very pleased with the timing, because obviously this is a debate that's going on very intensely right now. But one of the reasons we're most pleased that this is getting out to such a broad public, to, this is not just there, people across the country, not just people on the coast, will have a real chance to see the film, and veterans, the entire range of Americans. And so, this is an issue, regardless of what your position is on the wars, or regardless of whether you're Republican or Democrat. I mean, this is something I think we can come together as a country. I mean, we can all agree that we should be protecting the men and women who are protecting us. So I hope that this film does just that, is it sort of motivates people to stand behind these men and women and protect them, because this has been going on way too long. They're putting their lives on the line. This is not a risk that they should ever have to undertake.
Kirby Dick is the writer and director of The Invisible War, airing on WKAR Monday night at 10 o'clock as part of PBS's Independent Lens series. Mr. Dick, I am very grateful for your insight and your time. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR and at WKAR.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. What should America's energy future be, and how do we hammer out an environmentally conscious national energy security plan for the future? That is the preoccupation of Current State's next guest. John Hoffmeister is a former president of Shell Oil Company. Today, Mr. Hoffmeister heads the nonprofit group Citizens for Affordable Energy. He, T. Boone Pickens, and a few others belong to an interesting group of energy executives, or ex-executives, who are advocating for alternative energy sources. Mr. Hoffmeister speaks at noon today in Livonia at the Detroit Area Forum. John Hoffmeister, welcome to Current State.
Thank you for having me.
On your organization's website, under Purpose, it states, quote, "We deserve more affordable, cleaner energy," unquote. As you see it, what are the biggest obstacles standing in the way of more affordable and cleaner energy?
One obstacle is the near monopoly of oil in the engines that we use today, when we could be using multiple types of alternative fuels, even in the engines we use today, provided they are flex fuel engines. So we could shift from oil to natural gas in multiple different ways of managing natural gas as a transportation fuel in the cars of today as well as tomorrow. That's number one. Number two, we seriously lack in the government policies at local, state, and federal levels that truly enable this country to build out a new 21st century energy system, which makes us rely upon an elderly, decrepit 20th century energy system, which is just barely keeping up with today's demands and simply cannot continue much longer in the ways in which we have been accustomed. Those two areas could deliver cleaner, more affordable fuel that is going to serve us through the 21st century.
Some percentage of the time, more affordable and cleaner just don't go together. First and foremost, I'm thinking of coal here. How do you try to balance those priorities?
Well, I think coal continues to play a role because it has such a heavy investment from the past, and I have not, for one, given up turning coal into a cleaner fuel. The technologies exist, but we need to manage the public policies in such a way that utility companies would embrace clean coal technology, and that has not yet happened. But with respect to other cleaner, affordable fuels, starting with natural gas, which has half the pollutant capability of coal, we could go a long way towards both eliminating oil imports for this country, which we know cost us, as some station owners say on their stations, an arm and a leg, and move towards natural gas as methanol or as gasoline for personal cars, as compressed natural gas, as liquefied natural gas, or as gas to liquids, a diesel form, a type of diesel, with just natural gas. And this nation has more natural gas than we actually know we have, because every time the Energy Information Agency at the Department of Energy reports on how much natural gas we have discovered and that we can produce, that number's already out of date. We keep finding more.
I'd like to just briefly tick down a list of the common energy sources and have you briefly summarize your best current thinking on each one, with an emphasis on the environment on one hand and cost on the other. Not too tall of an order, right?
Well, let's go at it.
Do it all the time. Oil. Let's start with oil.
Well, oil has served us well, but it's time to compete other products against oil, because oil has become too expensive and in some cases too risky to produce. And when it costs too much, it doesn't serve the public well.
Natural gas.
Natural gas is prolific. It has many, many uses, not just electricity generation, but also transportation fuel. It's cleaner than oil. It can be used in today's engines as long as they're flex fuel and the computer software in the engine is converted, adjusted, I should say, to take advantage. It would clean the air tremendously to be using natural gas compared to oil.
I have to ask a follow-up question on that. What is the big stumbling block in creating more cars that burn natural gas?
Well, I think we have to get the cooperation of the automotive companies, and we have to build the infrastructure to be able to convert natural gas into transportation fuel, which means building methanol plants or building compressed natural gas plants or liquefied natural gas plants. That's beginning to trickle into the economy, but with the right government signals from Washington or from state capitals, this could happen very quickly. And so this is where government has to play a role by creating the enablers in public policy to signal to the marketplace, yes, it's okay to invest here. We don't need public money. It's important to know that. No public money. Let the private investors pay for it, because they'll get returns many times over once we convert to a different fuel than oil.
Let's continue down our list of energy sources. Coal.
Well, coal needs clean technology to be socially acceptable in the world of the future. And whether that's coal in China or whether that's coal in Australia or coal in the United States, I think we've reached a point of public resistance to the effects of coal. Not that it's a bad fuel, it's a dirty fuel. It works, but let's use technology to clean it up so that it is socially acceptable in the 21st century.
Wind.
Wind is an excellent source of energy when it blows. The problem is we can't tell it when to blow. So it's an intermittent source. But of course, as long as we protect the land in which we're building wind farms, it's really non-polluting, and it can be useful to us. But it's not going to solve all of our problems unless we had a storage system to store wind power when the wind's not blowing.
And finally, solar.
Solar, just like wind, it's an intermittent source of energy. I would argue that the technology to capture energy from the sun is still very immature, very expensive, and therefore not very efficient. But we'll change that with time. I think that innovation, technology, nanotechnology research, a lot of which can happen right here in the state of Michigan, can make a big difference on solar energy in the future.
We are broadcasting here, John Hoffmeister, from a city with a particular interest in the success of General Motors. We make Cadillacs and three crossovers here in Lansing. What's the role of federal CAFE standards here in 2013, and what role should they have in the future?
CAFE standards are designed around an oil-based internal combustion engine to try to get more miles per gallon with cleaner exhaust. And in principle, that is a noble objective, and we've made a lot of progress, and I think we can continue to make more. But let's be clear, we could change the fuels that we use in the engine to cleaner fuels, meaning that we could drop the price of gasoline and people would drive more and would pollute less. So natural gas versus gasoline, ethanol, methanol versus gasoline, and of course the electrification of vehicles. And so it would change the game. Government's a little slow to respond here, and we're not getting the leading signals from government that we could use. So while we're on this journey towards higher CAFE standards, which is predicated on old technology, old thinking about the role of the engine, I think we could convert our thinking to more progressive opportunities to drop the price of gasoline, drive more, and have cleaner air at the same time with competitive fuels.
We've got under a minute, but the explosion in natural gas has created at least one conundrum. It's cleaner than coal. It's not as clean as solar and wind. Is the growth of natural gas a net gain, or does it essentially reduce incentives to pursue even cleaner energy?
Well, we can't drive our cars with wind or solar energy, not yet. We're not electrified as a fleet. So before we can electrify the entire fleet and not worry about internal combustion engines, somewhere in the future, we need a different fuel, because oil is getting too expensive, too hard to get, and we're relying on imported oil far too much. Natural gas, we have plenty of it, to me represents the perfect alternative for the next, let's say, 50, 60 years, while we work on electrifying the fleet.
John Hoffmeister heads the nonprofit group Citizens for Affordable Energy. He speaks today in Livonia at the Detroit Area Forum. John Hoffmeister, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, Lou Glaser of Michigan Future talking about higher education for Michigan's economic future, and traveling to Cuba with the MSU Alumni Association. Stay close. It's Current State on WKAR. It's Current State on WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. In case you'd missed this, the field of Democratic candidates for Michigan governor grew a little thinner this week. John Austin, president of the State Board of Education and two-time current state guest, by the way, said Wednesday that Mark Schauer is Michigan's strongest Democratic candidate and Dems should rally around him and get the ball rolling for 2014. Schauer, by the way, has not officially declared he's a candidate, but the Detroit Free Press reports an announcement one way or the other is expected in the next couple of weeks. It's spring commencement time when tens of thousands of new graduates head out into the, quote, real world, unquote. Here in Michigan, there have been a lot of public conversations about how we train our students for jobs in this state, how we keep talent from leaving, how to attract new talent, and what our universities can be doing to facilitate all of this, from the proposed Michigan 2020 plan by state Democrats to rethinking the university corridor. There are a lot of ideas floating out there. Our next guest thinks that quite a bit of this discussion about jobs and education in Michigan is rather short-sighted and is missing the larger point. Lou Glazer is co-founder and president of Michigan Future, Inc., and he joins us by phone from Ann Arbor. Welcome, Lou.
Hi, Mark.
Just to start, explain to our listeners what Michigan Future is and what your goals are with the group.
Right. So we are a think tank that got started in 1991 around what was then a pretty unique notion, which is that for Michigan to be prosperous in the 21st century, we needed to make a transition away from a factory-based economy, which even then we knew was sort of irretrievably in decline, and make a transition to a more knowledge-based economy. So that's really been the core of our work for the last two decades.
Do you have a particular goal, though?
Goal? Yeah. So the goal is a high prosperity Michigan. It's which is different than sort of, I think, a lot of economic goals, which is sort of driven by unemployment rate. We want a place with a broad middle class with high per capita income. So what we've been trying to understand and constantly evaluate is what are the most prosperous places in the country, what are their core characteristics, and then what does Michigan have to do to be one of them once again?
There's been a great deal of discussion about training the next generation for the jobs in Michigan, the jobs of the future in Michigan. We hear that our state has thousands of jobs and no one trained to fill them. What role do our universities play in this?
Well, you know, I guess, I mean, from our perspective, we're pretty resistant to the notion that sort of the purpose of education, whether it's K-12 education, where there's sort of a real push now to reintroduce vocational training, or our higher education system, that the purpose is to prepare Michigan kids for Michigan companies. From our perspective, education is about giving every child an opportunity to maximize their potential, pursue their dreams sort of any place on the planet. So to us, that's way too narrow a sort of a goal for the education system. I don't have kids myself, but all of my friends who have kids and grandkids never define what they're looking for in education, whether it's K-12 education or higher education, as that limiting, as sort of wanting to sort of lower their kids' horizon to just an immediate job with some employer in Michigan. They're all looking, as they should, and we should for all of our kids, to really try to have an education that prepares kids to be successful adults, not just workers, but successful adults wherever on the planet they choose to live and work after school.
But why is training people for specific jobs not the best path?
I'd argue for a couple of reasons. The first one is that life is about more than just a job. So if you reduce education to just sort of vocational training and you take off the table being a good citizen, being a good consumer, being a good parent, I mean, there's a whole set of adult roles that our education system has always been designed for, and it's been one of the strengths of the American education system. But when you're looking at sort of K-16 education, you know, so if we want to move beyond that and just look at sort of education's role in preparing people for the economy, if you'd like. It has always been about, and even now more so should be about preparing people for a career, not just a job. And careers are 40 years or longer in a world in which globalization and technology are constantly changing sort of occupations, so that sort of the job skills you have today very likely are going to be obsolete pretty quickly. It's the people who are doing best are a couple of things. One, they are people with four-year degrees or more. They are by far the most employed, and secondly, they earn the most money today, and certainly that's true even more so over a career. But secondly, the asset that they have that they bring to the labor market, and it's what employers are increasingly looking for, are broad skills, not narrow job skills. So so this focus on sort of a job tomorrow, I mean, I think turns out not to be good for sort of individuals who are preparing themselves for careers. It also turns out not to be good for employers or the economy, because the skills go obsolete, and then folks not only lose a job, but they don't have the skills to get the next job and the next job and the next job.
Are you arguing in favor of a classic liberal arts education here, Lou?
Yep.
You are?
I mean, basically, yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's interesting. The conventional wisdom at the moment is that sort of a liberal arts education is of declining value. And I think if you look at what's going on in the labor market today and where jobs are going in the future, sort of that broad-based liberal arts kind of grounding is going to be an even higher competitive advantage going forward than it has been in the past. So, yes, I mean, I think the broader the education, the more likely it is that people have successful careers, and the more likely it is that they meet the needs of employers long term. Can I just tell you one sort of quick story? I mean, someone happened to send me a blog from a website called Spartans Helping Spartans.
Okay.
Which was written by a woman who graduated from MSU, I think in the 80s, 1988. She got a degree in advertising, but spent a lot of her time taking art history classes.
Okay.
And what her blog was about is how this supposedly uneconomic use of her time in education, spending time in art history, ended up being the core of the skills that she used in starting and developing her own successful social media company. So she was making the case, which I think is true over and over and over again, that stuff that people think are useless skills turn out to be really very important to building a career in a world in which, because of globalization and technology, we simply have no clue what's coming next.
Mm-hmm. How much contact do you have with Michigan employers? Is that a big part of your work?
I wouldn't say it's a big part of our work, our work tends to be pretty data-driven. I mean, we're really trying to look at sort of, you know, basically using sort of the data from the statistical agencies of the federal government, sort of what's going on in the economy. But having said that, we do have conversations with employers, and I think the interesting thing is that they all are pretty consistent when they talk to us about what they are looking for when they hire people. And increasingly, it is this broad set of really non-job specific skills. So they really are looking for people who are good thinkers, who are good communicators, obviously have a good work ethic, highly motivated, able to constantly learn and reinvent themselves. I mean, there's one employer that's written this notion that even though he's hiring for a job, he wants to know if the person he's hiring can do three or four jobs, because he doesn't know if the one job he's looking for is going to be around for a long time. So even employers, when you talk to them, describe what they're looking for as broad rather than narrow skills.
Do you hear about soft skills, so-called soft skills, people skills, punctuality, thank you notes, that kind of thing?
Yes. I mean, I think it's but I think it's broader than that. A lot of it is thinking skills, curiosity, ability to work with other people. I mean, it is. So our analogy is that we're moving into a labor market because of globalization and technology, where everything is so unpredictable and unstable, that putting together a successful career looks a lot more like rock climbing than ladder climbing. You know, we always had this notion of a career ladder, you know, where there were linear steps up the ladder, where you build on a set of sort of foundation skills that you learned early.
Mm-hmm.
Career ladders in a world where sort of occupations and jobs and even industries are sort of, nobody knows if they're going to exist for how long, are toast. So people are going to have, you know, what we call, you know, if you think about rock climbing, it's this ability to, you know, understand challenges and opportunities and then respond to them. It's what we call resourcefulness. Those are the set of skills that are going to matter most going forward.
We're talking with Lou Glazer of Michigan Future. Your group has a school component to it called Michigan Future Schools. Tell us about what they're doing there.
Yeah, so our work, the think tank work that we've been talking about, is funded by Michigan Foundations. And a number of the foundations who funded us about a decade ago came to us and said, we really like this think tank work that you're doing. But sort of at the top of our priority list is trying to figure out how you connect poor kids, predominantly growing up in Michigan central cities, to this new growing knowledge-based economy. So out of that has led an initiative which is called Michigan Future Schools, which we now do in addition to the think tank work, which is starting 10 brand-new college prep high schools for students in the city of Detroit.
Are they charter schools or public schools or both? Or
both. So we've chosen, you know, we're sort of through the process now over the last 3 or 4 years of choosing the 10 groups that we're going to work with. We chose them by competitive grant. It was open to public schools, charter schools, and private schools. We were, as we describe it, governance neutral. We're going to end up with 8 charter schools and 2 public schools.
You're opening 4 more this fall, I understand?
Right. There are 5 open now, 4 this fall, and then 1 more in 2014.
What do you make? You've got schools in the Detroit area. What do you make of the Education Achievement Authority discussion at the Capitol?
So, we've not tended to get involved in sort of figuring out who are the right operators or not kind of thing. But EAA has about, took over about 15 DPS schools, has about 10,000 kids. I guess our sense is that it is another of these sort of worthwhile experiments to figure out how it is that we provide a higher quality education to urban kids. I think like everything else, our schools, charter schools in general, the AA schools, I guess our sense is that with all of them, the experimentation is really worthwhile. It's just that I guess our sense with all of them is that there needs to be a reasonably high bar that they meet with sort of the schools they're currently operating before they're allowed to expand. So, I mean, I still think of us as really in the product development phase. We're still trying to figure out sort of what is the way or ways in which you can, either starting in kindergarten or, in our case, starting in the 9th grade, take urban kids like those in Detroit and really, provide education that ends up having kids leave high school academically ready for college. That's the challenge that we're having real problems figuring out nationally.
Okay, very good.
So, you know, so I guess EAA is one of, you know, is another one of these good experiments that's going on.
Lou Glaser is the co-founder and president of Michigan Future, Inc., a nonpartisan think tank based in Ann Arbor. You can learn more about their work and read Lou's blog at michiganfuture.org. Thanks, Lou Glaser.
Thank you.
Current state on WKAR. Welcome back. Michigan State University is offering adventurous members of its Alumni Association another chance to visit Cuba later this year. MSUAA has announced its plans to return to the Caribbean island in November. The excursion follows an earlier visit in March that included chances to meet the Cuban people and explore museums and factories and other interesting places. Here to talk about that first Cuban tour and about what's planned for the second, MSU Alumni Association Travel Director Regina Cross. Hi, Regina.
Hello. And it's a pleasure to be here.
It was a pleasure to have you. And Lansing's Mary Digert, who was on the March trip to Cuba. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
Regina, the Alumni Association is calling this a people-to-people exchange. What does that mean?
Well, people-to-people, it's actually the name of a license that we needed to obtain to travel to Cuba.
Oh.
And that is, we obtained the license from the Department of Treasury Office of Foreign Assets. And so part of the requirements of this license is that tour needs to be a full schedule of educational and enrichment-type activities and not tourist-based activities.
Okay. So that's basically the framework if you want to visit Cuba as an American citizen. Most Americans visit with that framework.
That's correct.
In play. Mary mm-hmm. Digert, what made you want to visit Cuba?
Well, my daughter talked me into it, actually. She had always wanted to go to Cuba, and so she called me one day and asked me if I wanted to go, and it didn't take me very long to say yes.
And you're glad you made the trip.
Absolutely.
What was the takeaway for you from a visit?
What we learn about Cuba comes from an American's perspective, and I was very interested in seeing the Cuban perspective of politics, of what they think of America.
What did you make of what they think of America? What did they say? What kinds of things did they say?
They were very friendly toward us.
Okay.
We were welcomed at every place. The only place that I saw any kind of anti-American thing was at some of the museums were from a Cuban perspective. For example, the Bay of Pigs Museum and the Revolutionary Museum were both mm-hmm. from a Cuban perspective.
Okay. Regina, are there handlers here on this, or is it clear that the people that you talk to are not prepared to discuss certain topics?
Well, for the most part, you know, during the tour we had opportunities to meet with people and visit like a ballet and meet with students from like a dance studio, or we went to a senior citizens, but those subjects never came up. We did have some people that lectured, but they would talk about the economy. But there wasn't a lot of talk, political talk. It was primarily learning about the people, and that was the main focus, was arts, culture, and having interaction with the people.
But do you think these encounters are managed in such a way that they avoid sensitive topics or topics?
I don't know that they avoid it. I think part of it could be also the language barrier, because a lot of who we spoke to or asked questions with were the questions were through an interpreter. So the people that were on the tour, I don't think that was their main focus. They were more interested in finding out about the people themselves.
Do many Cubans speak English? Did you run into many? Or
some. I can't say a lot.
Okay. Have you found yourself, Mary Digert, saying to people, "Oh, you should go to Cuba"? after your trip? Have you recommended Cuba as a destination to people that you've talked to about your trip?
Yes, I would. If people to people is your kind of trip, yes.
Yeah. It's such an exploratory thing. I mean, travel has opened up in recent years to Cuba.
Well,
it's not the novelty that it was 10 or 12 or 15 years ago, whatever.
That's correct, but because of the people-to-people licenses.
Yeah.
You know, I think the allure of Cuba is because we have not been able to easily access and go to Cuba. I think that's been the allure of it. And with the people that I've spoke to that were that signed up for the March trip and are signing up for the November trip, they said, I've just always wanted to go. I've just always wanted to go. So I think it's just more the allure of not being able to go that is in wanting to learn more about the country because they haven't had that opportunity before.
For anybody who's seen the movie The Buena Vista Social Club or any number really of other movies, it's common to see photos of even modern day Cuba that make it seem like it's frozen in the 1950s. You know, the cars and the architecture. Was that your impression, Regina?
Yes, yeah, very much. Well, to a certain extent. I mean, it's still a very much modern city, but I mean, it is very nice to see the vintage cars. Old Havana, you definitely can see the impact of the embargo because a lot of the buildings are not so much crumbling, but there's a lot of peeling paint and a lot of restoration needs to take place. But you can definitely see how it must have at one point looked beautiful.
Sure.
You know, and I think that's what I loved about Cuba was that.
Did you see a Prius anywhere?
I did not.
The pictures I've seen are just what dominates these photos are these big 50s American cars.
Yeah, and we had the opportunity to ride in them as well. Okay. We took a ride. Yeah, that was part of the tour experience. So. Okay.
Mary Dygert, what surprised you about your trip? What did you encounter that you did not expect?
Well, the classic cars were the one thing that. I mean, I had heard that there were a lot of them there, but I think almost half of the cars on the road were the classic cars. And the kinds of cars you see at a classic car rally here in the U.S., the 50s Chevys, Fords, even saw DeSoto and a few other names you probably haven't heard. And
it was a dream for the men on the trip because they were like, oh, my God, there's a 57 Chevy.
The best car show I've ever been to. Yeah.
Yes, they absolutely loved that portion.
The other thing that I was surprised at is how important the arts play a role in education. That is an extremely important part. And the fact that there's a National Institute for Writers, artists, dancers, musicians who are paid to do what they do. So they don't have to wait tables or some
it's
job like that.
It's a government underwritten program.
Correct.
To educate people in the arts.
Yes.
Correct. But that's part of the education, which is free at all levels. And the literacy rate in Cuba today is 99 plus. In 1961, it was 76%. So tremendous growth in the last 40 years.
We've got less than a minute. Regina, tell us some of the highlights on the itinerary in November.
Pretty much what we experienced in the March trip. Again, we'll be visiting a Jewish center, the Revolution Museum, some art museums. You'll get an opportunity to meet some artists. There's a ballet, and then there's a community, an eco-community in the hills that you'll have an opportunity to meet the people that live there and have an eco-friendly lunch where they grow all the vegetables and food there in the community.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Sounds great. MSUAA?
Yes.
MSU alum.
Yes. .com
if you want more
information. Alumni.msu.edu is the website if you'd like more information. And you can reach me at 888-697-2863 if you're interested.
And you might bump into Beyonce and Jay-Z while you're there. You never know. Yes. Coming up on Current State this weekend, it doesn't stop with Django and Lincoln. 2013 will usher in at least seven more films about slavery. That's Current State this weekend. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Yensia Wang for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okemos Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for Mother's Day. DouglasJ.com. And by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at LansingChamber.org.